Peter, fangst du an?
Okay. Herzlich willkommen zu einer Sonderausgabe unseres Podcasts aus dem Homeoffice, wo sich für einen Online-Coach eh nicht so viel ändert, nur dass man halt woanders trainiert. Alexander, wir haben heute eine, vor allem durch dich, eine besondere Ehre, weil er ja schon seit längerem ein Freund von dir ist. Wer ist heute zu Gast?
Heute zu Gast ist Mike Tushira. Jeder, der ihn nicht kennt, wird wahrscheinlich Probleme haben im Bereich des Powerlifting und Lebens generell, weil wahrscheinlich hat er Powerlifting in den letzten 10 Jahren, sagen wir, eigentlich wissenschaftlich, kann man fast sagen, mit seinen Methoden, revolutioniert. Angefangen von den Input über APIs, über seine Emerging Strategies, die er in den letzten Jahren etabliert hat, bis hin zum jetzt momentan gängigen, sagen wir so, Versuch, Stress zu tracken, hat er sicher einen riesen Impact auf Kraft-Dreikampf und das Krafttraining generell. Und das Coole an dem Ganzen ist, er gibt Informationen raus wie kaum ein anderer. Also er sagt eigentlich im Endeffekt alles, was es darüber zu sagen gibt. Er gibt jedem die Infos, die er hören will und versucht mehr oder weniger ja, sein Wissen in die Bevölkerung zu spreaden. Das finde ich extrem geil.
Auch nur so können wir besser werden, indem wir Dinge nach außen tragen, die wir glauben, dass sie so sind, aber in Wahrheit müssen sie ja alle erst in der Praxis ausgetestet werden.
Ne? Richtig.
Das heißt vor allem für nachher dann, wir werden uns oder wir versuchen uns auch in einem Englisch, zumindest einer Mischung aus Deutsch und Englisch in dem Interview.
Schwierig, weil unfähig. Und ich kann euch nur nachher, ich werde es noch merken, ich, Peter, bei dir ist weniger der Fall, bei mir ein bisschen mehr, man merkt es auch, ich fühle mich neben Mike einfach aus mehreren Hinsichten eingeschüchtert. Nummer eins, ja. Spaß, wie starker ist. Nummer zwei, es ist offensichtlich, dass er intelligent ist und man kann das jetzt erklären mit der Sprachbarriere, ist aber Bullshit. Es kommen Wörter vor von ihm, die kenne ich auch auf Deutsch, dumm aber schwarz, sie auf Deutsch definieren.
Es ist wie immer ein großer Unterschied zwischen aktiven und passiven Wortschatz. Auf Deutsch und auf Englisch.
Bei mir ist es primär viel passiv. Und die dritte Sache ist, jetzt wo ich ihn gesehen habe, muss ich sagen, ein Mensch, der mit dem Alter jünger und schöner wird, er hat eigentlich jetzt durch seinen Bart und eine neue Frisur hier hat er einen großen Impact auf mich und ich überlege mir, ob ich nicht auch so einen Bad-Look mache.
Ja. Na gut. Enjoy Emerging Strategies, Anwendung, Stressindex und generell Coaching-Philosophie allgemein. Unser Blick und vor allem wichtiger der von Mike Tushira.
Richtig. Und wie offen man sein sollte gegenüber unterschiedlichen Methoden. Genau. Viel Spaß. Vielen Dank.
This is Gino the announcer and you are listening to the Barbell Program Podcast with Peter and Alex. The bar is loaded.
But at least your beard is looking great.
Thank you. I just trimmed it recently and went a little shorter than I intended, but it's all right. It does grow back.
But we can conclude that Peter has the shortest one.
Yeah, right now I'm really embarrassed. Yeah.
How about you? Do you have a setup in your house or something? Are you able to still train?
For me, no. Actually, I just can do some body weight and some rubber band movements and stuff like that. I have some kettlebells, but to be honest, I have a pretty shitty coach right now, and the last block was no. But I'm a bit fucked up from the last block anyway. So it's probably not that bad to get at least 1 or 2 weeks off.
You know, we're trying to get his body weight up to 150 kilograms, so the body weight is enough just for his bench press, you know.
Just decrease my rate of
motion. You have to find new ways, you know.
This has all been orchestrated as a way to cause you to reduce your caloric expenditure.
Oh yeah, it's easy now. Okay, so Mike, we how can I say that? If it's fine for you, but I already told you that we will, you know, record the whole thing and put it on a podcast. Okay. That's great. Okay. So two days before, Peter and I were just talking about which topics we can, you know, we can talk about. And I just looked at your presentation of the European Congress, of the European Powerlifting Congress, and Peter was there. I couldn't make it in those days, but I'm very, very, very interested now in how you do the whole, you know, fatigue tracking thing within ES, because I looked the presentation up last week, and I was kind of, how can I say that, confused about the whole thing. I mean, I get it, but I don't get it in, let's say, detail.
Yeah. Well, it's so you said the key word that triggers me to go into like a psychotic trance, I think. You said fatigue, but it's definitely related to that. There's a whole bunch of places we can go with that, and some of the things I'm more sure of, and then some of the things I'm really not that sure of, but I know that the current way of thinking about it seems wrong, but I don't necessarily have a better way yet. So the presentation I gave really focused in on what I've been calling stress index for a lot of years now, and it's kind of, it's a way to try to quantify the recovery cost of a training intervention, a training session, a training week, anything like that. So yeah, there's that, I suppose, and yeah.
So you,
I don't know, I suppose I'll let you kind of frame it and take it where you want to go with it.
I thought about you say that the stress comes from kind of the damage on the muscle structure or the passive structure of the body, and on the other hand it comes from, you know, the like kind of CNS stress, like CNS psychological you kind of, how can I say that, you kind of accumulate during training on one side and life as it happens on the other side. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of makes the whole that rises, or, you know, declines the stress level.
Yeah.
Is that, it's correct. Okay. Because I was just wondering about, you know, the formula, or how do you kind of track that? I mean, for example, it's easy for me to understand how you track the whole thing within training, but how can you track the whole thing going on besides training?
That's something that I'm currently wrestling with quite a lot. So all the things that fall under the scope of like stress index are not that so much. So stress index relates to the training itself. And just like you mentioned, I think that there's two main sources of stress from training. There's the physical damage, and that's primarily caused by the volume, the mechanical work that you do. And then there's the psychological fatigue that comes about from training. And I think that's largely how you perceive the training. you know, my favorite example of this is if you talk to lifters who train in ways similar to Boris Shako, where you very rarely touch 90% weights, then 90% weights, if you ask a coach, if you ask Shako or a coach like Shako, like why do you so rarely touch 90% weights, he would say that it's because those weights are more stressful. And this was something that powerlifters believed broadly in the early 2000s and probably before. You know, 90% weights are more stressful than other weights. And then I would say probably somewhere around the 2009 or 10 time frame, the last big infatuation that powerlifting got with Bulgarian style training, and everyone was doing this daily 1RM stuff. And I didn't go as far as like daily one rep maxing, but I did and still do a lot of heavier singles. And what I found was that once I got used to it, it wasn't any more stressful than anything else. And it's like it seemed very stressful in the beginning because these weights were heavier than, you know, anything that I had handled in weeks. And but then when you handle it frequently, that goes away. You know, it's not a big deal. You know, it's a big deal in the sense that it's going to be heavy, but it's not this critical set that means so much to you. And it all comes down to this one moment. Like if you mess it up, that's bad, but you'll come back to it next week. So there's less psychological stress that comes with it on account of it being something you're exposed to frequently. And that made me think, like, maybe it's not anything that special about the 90% weights, but it's your psychological approach to it that makes it stressful. You know, so I tried to, my initial take on the stress index thing was to look at training that I had written and find patterns in training logs, basically. And that's where I came up with kind of the early stress index that I was using. And it's a bit crude, you know. And then later on, Robert Frederick wrote some articles about exertion load, completely independent of anything that I was doing. I hadn't spoken publicly about the stress index that I built. And, you know, he hadn't said anything until he wrote his articles. But, you know, I looked at what he wrote and what I had been doing, and it's like the numbers were different, but the shape of the curve, the underlying phenomenon that it tracked, was the same. And I thought, that's really interesting that, you know, we're both getting at a similar phenomenon, you know. And so from there, I kind of modified a lot of my work to include what he had written about, because his was a lot more refined than mine was at the time. So I included what he had written about and kind of continued developing it from there. So stress index, I guess, to get back on the point, stress index is not intended so much to capture the outside life stuff, but more to say generally this is what is going on in terms of training difficulty, and not difficulty in terms of, like, doing the training, but difficulty in recovering from the training. Capturing the other stuff, the life stuff, that's something that I've been working on for a long time. Like, we've had our track system on the website that asks the user a series of subjective questions, you know, and that should include, you know, more of the whole life sort of thing. But getting at the signal that's in the noise for that is quite difficult.
That's what I thought. If it's easy to track the training stuff, but if it comes to social life, probably like exams or something like that, and you drop a set or even you drop even a whole exercise for the week, this emerging strategy stuff then changes completely.
It changes a lot. It can change a lot. And the way I've begun to make sense of that as time has gone on is that it doesn't negate anything that you've learned at that point. It just adds, it just changes its reliability. So if I have an athlete who trains at the same time, eats a very consistent diet, has a very stable life, then the data that I get out of their training, I can be fairly certain is a reflection of the training. If you have a more chaotic life, then your certainty is less. But I don't think that makes any of the approaches, you know, fundamentally not true. You know, it's a bit harder to see the signal and the noise, but that's true in any sort of training approach. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, what's very important or what's very interesting for me is that those there's a lot of things going on in strength training regarding to different kinds of periodization or how periodization is seen and about how to track stress and so on. And I mean, you know, the whole thing now is much in advance to what science is saying, you know, because you cannot test the whole thing, you know, within scientific methods with athletes, and you cannot do that, you know, nowadays, because, you know, first of all, it has to involve a little bit in the whole powerlifting scene, and then perhaps somebody like, for example, Greg or, you know, all those guys are making kind of a scientific study about that. So that's always, I think, the hardest time to just evolve something, because there is not such a big of a scientific background about the whole thing. But for me, those times are the most interesting ones because it's just you are so much in advance to what other people are saying when you talk about, for example, stress tracking or something like that, like it was back in the days with the RPE system and so on. So for me, this time is one of the most important ones when it comes to new approaches, the new points of views regarding to strength training. And what I think it's very cool is that that people who are into it have to discuss the whole thing, because as you know, there is no scientific background, and the only thing you can do is to listen to other people and listen to what they think about, you know, for example, how do they track stress and how do they, you know, think about this training prioritization or this training prioritization. So I think this is one of the most important stuff ever, but not a lot of people are listening because there is like they want to have some kind of scientific background, but that keeps them 5 years away, you know, from what's going on right now. And I think that's very cool to have that.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on your taste for risk. You know, if you wanted to do a training program that you could have more certainty and the philosophy underpinning it, I can see where the stuff that I'm proposing is more risky, because I could very easily be wrong. But, you know, let's say that we're talking about bodybuilding. Is it likely that everyone talking about the primacy of volume in the scientific world is just wrong? I mean, most likely they're onto something, even if it's not 100% correct, right? So I get that. And I'm definitely open to the possibility of me being wrong in some important way on this.
I know what you mean. I can tell you that the whole... I'm pretty sure that the whole volume stuff right now in bodybuilding or even in strength training, it will go down in the next couple of years, because they completely neglecting, for example, intensity and kind of how that there is a kind of peak tension in the main lift when it comes to intensity, because nowadays they're all concentrating on volume, which is for sure an important part, but everything comes down to volume and increase volume and increase volume and increase volume. And that is kind of I think it's a little bit of a not that volume is a misconception, and not that volume is not important, but it's you are neglecting all the other.
Taking the idea too far.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that it's too much volume orientated.
Really, yeah. But when it comes to science, it's even the same with all the daily undulated or weekly undulated periodization. You don't have any studies with high level elite powerlifters with this kind of periodization. So it's pretty much the same with emerging strategies. You got no scientific proof in all the methods.
Well, I was discussing this with, I think it was Greg recently. And where we went with this is, it's like, well, if you're a beginner or you're working with someone that you don't have any real understanding about, then leaning on the scientific consensus is probably a good way to go. But then as you develop, you know, how important is it that we have, you know, robust scientific data on elite powerlifters, let's say, in what training interventions are best? Maybe it's not even that important, because by the time you get to that point, you've got so much of your own data. And we do know that individual responses vary. And I suppose that's in large part what Emerging Strategies is trying to do, is trying to get you to collect your own data in a sensible way. And then use what you learn from that. So I hear people say, and have said since I got into the sport, that, you know, well, you should only change one thing at a time in each training block. That way you know whether it's working or not. And I mean, I understand the theoretical idea going on there, that, you know, it's variable control, and that's a big part of the scientific method. But it's... You do have to balance variable control and robust scientific inquiry with, you know, pragmatic concerns of being an athlete. You know, that if you only change one thing in each block, it's going to take you forever, literally forever, to get anywhere important. And that doesn't even do a great job of variable control, because that assumes that the only meaningful variables are in the training program.
Yeah. Well,
the subject, you know, you're talking about doing training experiments essentially with a subject of one, and this subject gets older every training block, you know, and they get more training mileage every training block, and maybe they get injured, maybe hopefully they get stronger, but maybe they don't. Maybe they, you know, something changes and now knee wraps are allowed, and then knee wraps are not allowed, or something like that, you know. So things change, and that will change the meaning of the evidence that you're gathering. So I don't think being a hardliner in terms of variable control is, it just doesn't make sense. So that's kind of where I come with the emerging strategies thing. It's like, well, if we do as good of a job as we reasonably can with the variable control, then the rest of it should be okay. Sorry. Kiddo wants to come in and visit. So if we do as good a job as we reasonably can with a variable control, then the things that we're going to learn the best information that we can.
Essentially. Okay. I guess this, what I wanted to address before is that the reason why it's not that stupid to just look at the history of strength science, because, you know, I think a lot of people are missing the history of strength science, and they are not looking back to what really great coaches were doing, because they say, okay, this is kind of UdSSR stuff, and everybody was on drugs back then, and so on and so on, and it's old, and it's something like that, and everybody wants to invent the, you know, the wheel as a new one, but it's kind of, there are a lot of people who were just talking about strength training back in the days in the 70s or 80s. And today, people are talking about the same stuff they were talking back then. And, you know, they are missing 50 years of strength science. And I don't get that, because you always told in your podcast and so on, you were looking to, for example, Anatoly Bondarchuk and his periodization models and so on. And I know that there could be an issue that everybody was on drugs back then. But nevertheless, I mean, the scientific structure of the old UdSSR was about, they had more than 1,000 strength athletes, you know, and they were really high class. And so the scientific method, they have to be kind of better, or not the methods, but the outcomes. Perhaps they are better than the outcomes we have now with kind of sports students, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I'm pretty sure that it's very important to just look back in history, and perhaps I know that because I used to be a history teacher, you know, but looking back in history saves time. And as you just said, that you just have so much time for one athlete, because after 10 years of training, okay, she's getting kind of too old, you know. It helps you as a coach, because you can be really good as a coach for 70 years. Okay, no problem with that. And there are a lot of good coaches who are 70 years old, you know, but you cannot be a good athlete. I mean, kind of world-class open athlete with 70 years.
Yeah, it changes things for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you about, you know, the historical context being a way to save time. And I think it's not that hard to look at the circumstances that are around it and, you know, make a judgment on how useful is this information. So like the thing about Bondarchuk, the thing that I drew from him was had more to do with how to classify exercises and how to organize training so that you could understand the results that you were getting for each athlete, and a way of individualizing that. Does rampant drug use impact that? I mean, I don't think it does. I can't imagine, you know, a higher testosterone level, let's say, or anything along those lines, changing the epistemic framework for how you learn things. Like, no. So things like that, might it affect specific methods? You know, like there was the whole, I forget the specifics of the story now. I want to say it was maybe York Barbell Club that was a major proponent of isometrics back in the 50s, must have been the
50s. I think it came from the East German science. Or how can I say that? The East Germans were the first who just did something like isometrics.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was an American gym that adopted it. Invented it or not, not important, I don't think. But they adopted it and started popularizing it in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And you know, isometrics got really popular, and people were doing them. At one point, you know, someone's doing an interview with one of these old guys, and he's talking about how they would do amphetamines before the workouts, and then they would do different drug after the workouts to come back down, and you know, just crazy stuff, you know. And you think, might that have an effect on whether or not isometrics are effective or not? Yeah, that might have an effect, you know. So the context of the thing matters a lot. And I mean, it's a thing that we say all the time. So I wouldn't, it just seems silly to me to throw out all of history and say like, well, I can't take anything from this because of this reason or that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the context matters. You can take what you can take and not any more than that.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. Yeah. Because, you know, I was, you know, I always, and I know Peter doing the same, we always try to get the main point out of, let's say, a program or a mindset of a coach, you know, a mindset of a coach who is doing a program, because everyone has his bias, you know. If you look at a program, and you probably know where it comes from, and be trying to get out the most important points of a program, and trying to, everybody's saying that you shouldn't mix programs, but I'm completely different in that opinion. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you should, you know, because you should take the best of something, and if it works, probably it's working on its own too. It shouldn't be in one program. It can work also in another program, you know. And yeah. I think that's a kind of very important thing, because as I was listening to, for example, emerging strategies at the first time you were talking about it a couple of years ago, I really tried to, you know, look back in the old days and reading you know, like kind of history science, strength science books and so on. And what was always interesting for me was that there are kind of two different frames. There's one thing that you should constantly change, you know, the exercises and the variables and everything, you know, just to keep your nervous system capable of learning new things and not to reach some kind of ceiling, you know. And there's the other thing, that you should keep the whole thing a little bit the same, you know, and figure out what's working and what's not. So I'm pretty sure somebody can connect that, you know. It's kind of hard. Yeah. I didn't figure it out, but I don't want to say that's the Holy Grail, because it's not, but I think that's the way perhaps we should focus our work on, or at least I'm doing that.
What I found out when I tried it a bit with my athletes, some of them are really good at doing the same workout for at least a 4, 6, 8 weeks block, and some of them are more used to changing the variables very often. And I think it depends a bit on the lifter, how your outcome is.
Mm. Yeah,
absolutely. But well, sorry, Mike.
This idea always kind of puts me kind of, I don't know, closer to Paul Check land. But I've wondered what it is about a thing, about a training program, that causes an athlete to stop adapting to it, you know. And I've had some conversations with some really bright people, and if you look at it mechanistically, I don't see what it would be, you know. If I say that one theory might be that you are accumulating fatigue, and that once you've accumulated enough fatigue, you can't display any more gains in strength. And that kind of triggers the end of the block. And then you go into a pivot and reduce the fatigue and so on. Yeah, maybe, but that's not the perception of the athlete, at least when we do it correctly. They shouldn't feel like they're accumulating a lot of fatigue. And that also wouldn't explain how the number of exposures thing comes into play, because that, how is it that, you know, if you double the exposure rate, even on a program with less volume, then you peak sooner. I mean, that shouldn't be, if it's only fatigue, it shouldn't be. So anyway, long story short, where I come down with it now is, I think that the athlete's ability to pay attention, to be engaged and bring energy to the training session matters, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you get a lot of psychological variation there. Some athletes are fine with it, and they can come in every week. If the weight is 5 pounds heavier, that's enough. It's got their attention and they're engaged. Other athletes are like, it's the same effing thing over and over. And especially if the block isn't going that great, or they just perceive that it's not going that great, then it's a lot harder to get that engagement. And I think that engagement is maybe, that might be the thing that is driving, that's driving the whole peaking process. So I suppose it doesn't surprise me that you know, some people, my clients are going to be selected at this point, that if you're coming to me for coaching, you kind of know what you're going to get to some extent, and you're bought into to this process, this idea. At least if you were totally opposed to it, you're going to filter yourself. So I think it's normal that I find that I don't find very many athletes who have a big problem with it. But it makes sense to me that someone who doesn't have that same selection bias is going to have a different experience, and that, you know, you might have more issue with, geez, this is the same workout again, you know, and it might lead to shorter peaking or, you know, needing to change something.
Yeah, which leads to another question. You mentioned that if a block isn't working very well, is it possible for you in this kind of setup to end on block early? What would be the reason for ending a block early? Because you have those three different responding types to emergent strategies, and one is building up, building up, building up, and then has his peak. So how do you, or can they change? Is the adaption changeable?
Absolutely, yeah. It should, it probably will change for each block that you do. So some blocks are like that, where you are just very stagnant until the very end. And then at the end, you may have a dip before the peak, which is its own little mindfuck. I think it's difficult to make the call. And if you were operating in a pure emerging strategies setup, then you probably shouldn't end blocks early. But I think in the real world, you know, you have athletes that are like, look, I'm not enjoying this, you know, or maybe they have a pain issue or something like that. The only thing I would say is if a lift is actively regressing, you know, it's getting worse each week, then there's no response type that should make a pattern out of getting worse from week to week. And the other thing is timing, you know, so maybe you're looking at your competition schedule, you know, and you've got a block that you're not crazy about, it's going okay. And you say, well, if we end it now, then we can do this. We have this option. Whereas if we see this block to the end, then we're more limited by time, you know, so that could kind of change the decision-making as well.
How is it? Is it, for example, is it hard for you to be two persons or two minds in one person? Like you are the scientific thinking person who would just try to find something new and test it and trying to get people better with the new thing. And on the other hand, you know that that's kind of a new thing, and there are a lot of other things that are working. And as a coach, perhaps you should, you know, change your approach. So for me, for example, I figure out, man, I try to put this, for example, athlete on the new program just because I want to figure out if it's working or not. But I shouldn't do that because I know exactly that other things will work. So I'm in a discussion with myself all the time. For example, I know this is new for you, but how do you? I don't know, find the word, but how do you do that?
You know. You mentioned something earlier that made me think of Mladen Jovanovic and complementary pairs, which I think that idea itself doesn't get enough credit. I think there's a lot of utility there. But I had some rather clunky language around this, but he put it a lot more succinctly with like the explore-exploit pairing. So I was calling some training blocks exploring blocks, where we were looking for the new things that might work. And then other blocks, I was calling them focus blocks, but exploit is a better word. You know, you're exploiting the knowledge that you've gained and emphasizing the things that you know will work. I do find that in my own training, because I write my own training as well, that I'm perpetually exploring. Just basically every block is an explore block, you know, and that's not balanced, you know. Usually what happens is the competition schedule helps to regulate it. Mm-hmm. So once you have a couple of competitions or you are within a couple of blocks of a competition, then you start to do more of the exploiting blocks. And then when you're further away, you can do the exploring blocks. I had one athlete I was working with that was competing like every 2 months, every 3 months, maybe. So we were always doing the exploit blocks. And that's too much as well. But it starts to get obvious, I think, at a point. And you start to say, look, we need something more of an off season, you know, or something like that, you know, so we can do more of this exploring stuff. I mean, the other side is someone like me who's not currently competing and then just goes into explore mode forever. So,
I kind of know that because that kind of freaks me out every time I'm writing a new program or a program for an athlete, and I think, hell, I just want to try that. And I always talk to the athlete. I just, you know, I'm doing the same. I figure out when it's the next competition and can we do that and so on. But sometimes you're in between a kind of scientific thinking and coaching thinking. So
it's
kind of
hard stuff. That's a good place to be, though. Especially if you talk to the athlete about it and get some buy-in. But I'd see similar things to myself, like themes in programming. A couple years ago, I kind of revisited this idea of triphasic training from Cal Dietz, which is, I mean, it's an idea that I forget when he first published that, but it's been around for a little while, but it just popped up again. And I thought, you know, that's a different take from the hammer the weaknesses focus of training that I had been doing a lot of. And I thought, well, let's build some strategies that incorporate that. And so one was an eccentric focus block, and another was a isometric focus block. And then I figured at the time that just normal training was pretty concentric focused anyway, which I think there's some more interesting things that you can do there. But anyway, so at the time I had these two blocks. One was eccentric, one was isometric. And I did them for myself. And I had a few athletes who are always pretty interested in experimenting, so we did it. And for the most part, we got some good results. So then we started implementing it more widely with my athletes. And it's not like a top-down, you know, okay, phase one complete. We need to move to phase two, which is implementation across the RTS system. Like, it's not that. It's just that things go in trends, and like at that moment, I was kind of interested in this idea. We'd seen some early success with it, so it's like, why not try it? And we had a lot of people who, not everybody, some people did not do well with it, but a lot of people did do well with it. Particular, the eccentric focus block.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, started seeing. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. So I was doing that when we were working together, and this kind of helped my squat going up, I think, 40 kilograms in within kind of half a year, because it also, because of my stupidity and my freakness, I fucked myself up a little bit, but the if I would have done it, you know, the correct way as you mentioned it, it would be one of the greatest things I'd ever done.
It's weird. It's strange like that. That, I mean, so the eccentric focus block, essentially what that is a lot of 6 second eccentric work. It's very similar exercise selection, as anything else that we would have done. It's just really slow eccentrics. So it's not that you're using extra heavy weight like weight releasers. It's not that you're doing anything all that different in terms of reps. In fact, you're probably doing less reps because each rep takes so long. You know, so 6 second eccentric squats, 6 second eccentric split squats, 6 second eccentric benches with feet up, you know, things like that, right? And yeah, we would see a lot of people who had a really surprising response, surprising positive response. Some people, it just kind of was just okay. But I still don't know exactly how to explain that mechanistically. You know, maybe it's technique. Maybe it's technique, but it's not any visible changes to technique, right? Maybe it's some sort of neuromuscular factor that gets changed. Okay, but what is that, and why does just slowing down your eccentric change it?
Yeah, I tried those stuff also, and the most changes or the valuable changes that I saw were the technical changes, or at least the athletes were able to, you know, there's a reduced weight and they are not so focused on I can hit a set of three with this weight. It's just do the 6 seconds eccentric, technical perfect. So probably
this was the same as me. I think the technique was more, it was more focused. I could focus more on the technique and in specific parts of the lifts where I didn't focus on the technique. You know, it's just I go going down, and then suddenly there was in kind of 10 centimeters where I lost form during normal speed, and that kind of moved the bar away from, you know, the perfect line. And another thing I think was that especially, you know, in when you are down in the squat, for example, it just helped me to put on kind of a lot of muscles, you know, on the glutes. This was what I found, because when I started the program, I thought, okay, my jeans are not fitting anymore, you know. it was kind of a great experience, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's clear that eccentric focus training does something different than concentric focus training or normal cadences, but what exactly that is or why it would be useful, I don't think is quite as clear. But it's still really interesting to me, you know.
I have another question when we come back to, you mentioned before the exposures of one lift during a cycle when it comes to time to peak. So you got your different time to peak, for example, for squat, bench, and deadlift. How do you implement that in a block? Do you just count the exposures from this special lift? Or so, for example, if I have a time to peak for squat with 6 weeks and for bench just for 5 weeks?
I haven't had that happen on a scale that's not in some way controllable. So if it's 6 and 5, you know, I think easy enough to manage. What you wouldn't want is for your squat to be 5 and your bench to be 8, you know, or something like that. If it was off by that much, that would be a problem. And I haven't ever seen that be the case. Usually when it looks like that, it's that something in the shorter program didn't work. So in that case, maybe the bench, it just didn't work. But if we're only off by 1 week, then... So here's the other thing, and this is kind of I don't know if it's an inconsistency in the philosophy or if it's just something that warrants some explanation. The whole theory underpinning emerging strategies is that your individual responses are in some way not predictable. So we need to have a systematic way of measuring them and finding patterns in training so that we can then use that. But those patterns are not stable. The patterns will change with time. And then we do something with time to peak, which is in your first block, you test it, and then that's it. You know, mm-hmm. if your first block is 8 weeks, then it's 8 weeks. Well, that's not exactly consistent, you know. So I think where I'm at with this now is that we'll retest time to peak periodically. And also just normally in the blocks. So I can look back at the block reviews, and let's say that we think that your time to peak is 5 weeks. So we're doing most of our blocks at five exposures, 5 weeks. And if we consistently notice that, you know, one or two lifts are peaking on the fourth exposure, then we may want to do something different with that. But what I've noticed is that it's not clockwork. It's not, you know, bang every fifth week, bang every fifth week. You know, it's mostly, you know, if I've got an athlete where I'm pretty confident it's 5 weeks time to peak, it's like mostly we get five exposures and that fifth exposure is the peak. Occasionally it'll be the fourth exposure. Occasionally you'll get a program that doesn't work at all. So there is a bit of unpredictability that's still there. So I wouldn't go as far as like really trying to time it as far as starting different programs at different intervals and things like that, unless you had someone that had different times and they were very consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was the number one rule is to follow trail of athlete response. So if you have a very consistent response like that, then go for it. I just haven't had that. So what I find myself doing, you know, bench is mostly 5 weeks and squat is mostly 4 weeks. Well, we'll probably lean closer to peaking the squat, you know, peaking on that fourth week, placing the competition on that fourth week. And then the bench comes in a little bit under peaked, but it's still improving, and that's a better place to be for the total. Because if you do start it differently, and that happens to be the block where bench peaks early, then, you know, that could be a worse outcome. And I think that, you know, in the sense that these things are always a little bit unpredictable, that it makes sense to hedge your bets that way.
You know, this is for me one of the biggest things in emerging strategies, that you just came up with this kind of new, perhaps not new, but it was new to the powerlifting world. You know, this new thing, like there is a time to peak. It's not about, okay, is it consistent or isn't it, but nobody really thought about that. I mean, you have your program, it was 8 weeks, for example. Here you're starting with this kind of weight and this kind of sets, and then you ending up with 2x2 or something like that, you know? So It was sure that you have 8 times to peak, but you never thought about what if it's different. So the big thing in emergent strategies and what you can get out of the program for me, for example, is that you should think about there is a time to peak. And there's a time to peak in within every person. And it's different because of they're doing different programs and that there are different people. And with every program, there comes a different time to peak. But you are thinking about the time to peak. It's a new program variable you have to think about. And it wasn't there before, you know?
Yeah.
So this is what I got out of emergent strategies. And it will ever be there, you know? There,
yes.
you cannot stop thinking about time to peak anymore, because
probably
that's a probably thing, you know.
Yeah, but probably because we're used to taper, we used to write the taping block, taper block, or a peaking block. It's just like it always was like that, you know.
Yeah.
And there's and to be honest, there's scientific proof that the taper works. So.
Yeah.
But yes, then you think that there is also a kind of time to peak, and you have to, you know, take this into consideration when you're writing a program, you know. And you, I didn't put it into consideration 5 years ago, for example. It was just a taper block, but I was not thinking about time to peak. And that's the beautiful thing, you know.
With the tapers, though, the way I think about tapering, so in the basic, I guess, the fundamental version of merging strategies, there's no taper. You place the competition on the peak exposure, and you work backwards from there, and you train normally up to the competition. You may rest for 2 or 3 days prior to the competition just to reduce any immediate fatigue. But essentially, those last 2 or 3 days of rest is the only tapering that happens. So it's kind of a no taper approach. It's not intended to be, you know, to really boost performance. It's intended to be a consistent high performance. So that if I notice that you're consistently peaking on the fifth exposure, that I can bet on that and that I can place the competition on that day, and chances are you're going to have a good day. Is it going to be the best day of your life? Depends on the block, I guess. But it won't be all that different from what you were capable of in training, you know. And there's a few things operating in the background there. One is that for me personally, I've never been able to get the boost effect that people talk about with tapering. You know, that if you're capable of a 200 kilo squat, that with a taper, you know, now all of a sudden it's 215 or 210 even, you know. Now, if I'm capable of a 200 kilo squat, then if I screw up, it will be less. But no matter what I do, it probably won't be more, you know, at least not very much more. I do also see that some people tend to really respond well to the competitive environment, that when you put them in front of an audience, that they perform well almost regardless. So I think that what can sometimes look like a performance boost from the taper might actually be a performance boost from the situation, the environment. So I'll happily admit that part of that approach is my bias from not having great success with, tapers and things like that. However, I think a good system needs to help coaches overcome that bias. And the way that you would do that with an emerging strategies approach, if you want to try a taper, you should. And, you know, we definitely use traditional tapers. I'd say about 50% of the time I have traditional tapers with my athletes. And I think the best way to go about that is experimentally as well. So classically, one thing that I've done is I'll have the athlete go through their warm-up sequence about 3 days out from competition. It's not stressful. It's just something to get them moving. But I had an athlete who just absolutely hated that. And felt it was contributing to a negative performance. We need to find something else. I think, you know, at least look around to see if there's something we can do that would be a better contribution to performance. So you can follow a similar emerging strategies style approach of testing different tapering approaches and seeing which one results in the best peak for an individual athlete. And that way you can individualize the tapering approach too.
What did you do with that person?
Well, we changed the change the warm-up. So there's another interesting bit of psychology, I think. A lot of times, say that you have them take their opener 6 days from competition. And I know that different people do that differently, but let's just say it's 6 days before competition. In my experience, many times that will move quite badly. So their opener squat, bench, deadlift, 6 days out doesn't look great. You know, and if you were to just look at that, you would say, maybe this opener is too much. But I've done it enough to know that in six more days, it'll be fine. That this is often a workout that's just not that great. So, again, I think just seeing the patterns and making use of that information is a big part of what coaching is, you know.
We had that situation last year about 1.5 weeks out from the Western European Cup with the Quip team. Alex was there also, I think. And all of the openers looked bad and didn't move well. And I think we had about 90% good attempts at that, or over 90% good attempts at that championship. So it's just like you just have to know your athletes then.
Yeah.
And we had also some good camps, and then we had bomb out. So it's not a not a scheme.
Yeah. Well, Peter, you strike me more as I don't know. Would you describe yourself as a coach who's a little less willing to break with I guess traditional methods or something like that? I don't quite know how to characterize it, and I apologize if I'm kind of mischaracterizing
No, actually I'm not, because I have about, I don't know right now, about over 40 athletes that I take care about, and I think I have 40 different setups for them. Some of them are more like Alex and I talked a lot about the conjugate system the last week or last month. So I have some of them I try a conjugate approach, and some of them it's a, like, I don't know, kind of traditional RTS style approach. It's like we talked before, it's super important to implement all of the good stuff from all of the programs.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of trial and error with all of them involved, always.
We're trying to bring, you know, emergent strategies and conjugate together.
Actually, we talked about that. It's not that far apart as you think
about
it first.
It isn't that far apart, no.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to me, even the emerging strategies framework is an empty framework, you know, that you can put a conjugate approach in there. It's a way of thinking about the information you get from training. And it requires some modification, but if you were to do it in a conjugate system, if you were to do it in a 5x5 system, you know, pretty much anything. Let me put it this way: I've taken inspiration from all of those systems. Basically, any system that appears credible to me, I've taken inspiration from it and written a strategy to use based on just what you're talking about. Like, I see the essential elements, and I see the thing that I say that looks like it might be the piece that's driving this program.
Yes.
Yeah. So how can I take that element and place it into this emerging strategies framework and build a program around it?
Yep.
And now that can become its own strategy. And you know, I talked about the triphasic thing. So, okay, I've got this eccentric focus block. I've got an isometric focus block. I've got some blocks that take on more of a conjugate flavor, some blocks that are, you know, keeping with the older way of, like the older tendencies that I had in my own programming, some blocks that utilize. So I utilize a lot of exercise variations compared to many other coaches, but I have blocks that don't utilize exercise variations very much, you know.
Yeah.
So Yeah, I think having a big big arsenal of different things that you can draw from is good.
I think that's the main thing. You know, on one side, you should figure out in kind of. If you can, you should figure out in kind of new system. But on the other hand, it's just one of one system, and it's not more or less important than all the other ones who you can give credit to, you know. But because it's, for example, if I figure out something, I think, oh, okay, I figured that out, and that's kind of my system. It becomes the most important one for me. But then I have to, you know, I have to. Then it's for some person it doesn't work. You have to take yourself back a little bit and then say, okay, let's step back and try something different.
Because then you're stuck in a system.
Yeah, then you're lost.
Yeah.
Well, one of the neat things to me, I'm sure you guys have seen this as well, like you may start at any of those points. You know, you may start with, a conjugate-focused block, you know, and as you do that block and you do variations of that block and you try other things, you start to build up this data pool on that particular athlete's response.
Absolutely.
The cool thing to me is when you kind of abandon those prior written strategies, you know, and that you're basically free-handing the whole block because you've got enough data on what the athlete responds to that you're kind of it's like a jazz strategy, you know. You're just mixing different elements together to make its own thing. Or another way to think of it is, say you're going to paint a picture. You know, in the beginning, you kind of have these stamps, and you're putting stamps on the paper. So it's kind of a preformed thing, and you put the stamps together, and you can make a good picture using just stamps, right? But at some point you say, let me move beyond the stamps and use a brush or do it freehand. Mm. And you can do things that you couldn't do with the other system once you move past that point.
Yeah. But what I figured out is that it's very important for me to just monitor the history of my interventions to the athlete. Because when you don't do that, and after 2 years you are getting back to the things you already tried, you know. But if you don't track all the things, all the stuff you have already done, and then that kind of could be a problem, you know. Because then you don't know what the intervention was. Because as you say, after a kind of time, a couple of months or something like that, you're kind of getting. He's freestyling the whole thing, you know, because you know, okay, this guy is not responding to that, but perhaps to this. And when you don't monitor the whole thing, perhaps you get lost in the whole process.
Well, that's an interesting question. And what do you guys think? How long should your memory be as a coach? You know, so if you try something, you try. Some, let's say, make it something specific, and it's split squats, and the athlete doesn't respond well to it. So you say, okay, let's throw that out. How long should it be before you try that again? Presumably, you should try it again at some point.
First of all, I try to keep it like a coaching diary, you know? I just put it in a kind of in the same Excel sheet, or not in the same sheet, but in a different sheet, and just writing down what I'm doing and what I'm not doing. But for example, if somebody's having pain doing kind of or doesn't get anything out of, for example, front squats, I put it out of the program completely. But if I know, okay, front squats would be a really, really, really great exercise for this guy, I try to put it in the program again, you know, but there is no exact time frame. It's kind of feeling, you know. I'm sorry for saying that, but it's kind of feeling. And now we have to try it again. But in between, I'm doing exercises that mimics the front squat, but he doesn't know it.
Right.
You know, because he's getting used to, you know, the knee angle, he's getting used to the upright body posture, he's getting used to the spine, you know, strength. I don't know how to put it, but he's getting used to the movement. And then when I put it back again, then it doesn't feel that weird again, and he can do it, for example. And he's getting out something out of it. I figured out that a front squat for me, I know exactly that front squat on me are really a good thing, you know, but I hate them and I cannot do them. And it's just, every time I try every version, it's just kind of shit. And the last, let's say, 2 weeks, I figured out what the problem is. And it's you. It's me. And it's a couple of, the big thing is that I was talking to Megan Jones, you know her, and she said I have really big issues involving my quads in the deepest position of my quad of my squat, and I should try some kind of zombie squat variations just with the barbell on a squat ramp going down the whole way. Don't look at your spine, everything, but just go down all the way, and I can barely move the barbell out of the deepest position. You know, it's insane. But I know exactly, if I'm doing that for another 2 months, I can't do front squats easily, you know, because that's the missing link. Yeah. So I try to, for my clients or for my athletes, I try to find, you know, exercises that mimic the exercise they cannot do, but I know exactly that they have to do because that's very important for them.
Yeah, I think it depends on what level your athletes are. When I think about my international competing athletes, I think in seasons. So usually we have the Europeans and Worlds. So right before Europeans or Worlds is not the best thing to put in a new move, or at least put in a movement that they know they don't like or they don't improve. But this at the time of the year after... probably after Europeans, because mostly they're in November. It's the time of the year that I try to do this stuff again and again. Because most of the times the adherence is also greater than or better than. That's the time of the year when they get movements that they hate. Most of the time.
I'm like you guys that I don't have like a certain hard timeline for it, but I've been thinking lately that 2 years seems to be reasonable for most circumstances. Mm. That, and I like the front squat example, but maybe even a rep example would be better. That, like, I've had athletes that don't do well with high intensity training, that whenever they go toward higher intensities, 85%+, that they start to feel, stiff and beat up and sometimes even get kind of injured a little bit. But we've trained them almost exclusively at lower intensities and had a lot of success with that. So I think once, you learn that fact and then you've gone a long period of time and you haven't done a block that's higher in intensity in, say, 2 years, it might be worth reinvestigating that, because mm-hmm. things change. You know that, mm-hmm. 2 years ago, maybe it didn't work. But maybe now, your situation is different. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the same could be with different exercises or things like that. So, and that's just a rule of thumb. Sometimes it seems... If you've got an athlete who's improving rapidly, I wonder if that timeline shouldn't be shorter. And you've got an athlete who's not, maybe they're getting close to their limit, and so they're not improving that much anymore. I wonder if that timeline shouldn't be longer for those for those types of athletes. Mm. That's interesting. I do like the idea of kind of being intentional about when you try those things in the annual plan, and then also intuitive about it as well, that it doesn't have to be a hard timeline. Mm-hmm. hey, we haven't tried this in 2 years or however many years, that it doesn't have to be that firm. You know, a lot of people do seem to have issue with coaches doing making more intuitive decisions, you know, but that seems to be valid to me. Of course, we try to make rational, deductive decisions when possible, but sometimes you just have a gut feeling that something's going to work or not work. And I think that's all right, too.
Yeah. You know? And you won't find out if you don't try it.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Guys.
Yeah, first of all, thank you very much for that. That's a great honor to get all the inside views.
Yeah, well, it was good to have a conversation with you guys. Always like talking with you guys about training stuff.
Right out of Brunsum in Netherlands. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I will never forget, it's close to Geilenkirchen. In Germany. Okay, Mike, thank you very much for taking the time for this kind of podcast interview, because your schedule is really full because you have two kids and you're a coach and you're doing RTS stuff, and you know it's kind of, I know you're only sleeping 4 hours a day for the last 10 years. And in the next podcast would be about why you're still looking so good and we are not, and because this would be very interesting for a lot of our viewers, so greetings to Ayana and your kids, and we will hear again.
All right,
thank you.